Well, would you believe that ABC Rural is the proud owner of the world's longest-running radio program? This year, the Country Hour is 70, and we're celebrating some of our big moments with you. To give you a taste, here's a mashup of what we sounded like in the 1970s. Let's join Melanie Sim.
This will be the last Country Hour for the 1970s. Let's look back on the decade that's just about finished.
Good afternoon, Alan Humphreys with the ABC's Country Hour, and in today's programme we'll be hearing news of a new breeding unit established at the University of New England and also a very handy device for moving grain.
Perhaps everyone at your place would like a big lump of fillet steak for the evening meal tonight, but you say you can't possibly afford it. Well, you have two alternatives, perhaps going back to the old tradition of a meatless Friday, or how about this advice from the president of the Victorian Division of the Meat and Allied Trades Federation.
There's nothing nicer than a nice casserole dish which can be made from the cheaper cuts of four-quarter cuts of meat. So you don't have to be living on rump steak and fillet steak and T-bone steak to get in proper nutrients from meat.
You're listening to the ABC's Country Hour. It's 18 minutes past 12.
One of the first things that the United Dairy Farmers of Victoria did was to try and help overcome this gap by organising what they called a Dairy Sunday.
So every dairy farmer's having the opportunity to entertain a guest, show him around, tell him what the situation is, let the kids meet the cows, feed the calves, do what they like, and generally have a good day.
We'll move on to Flemington now, and with our report on the Sydney fruit market, here is Ben Moody.
It has been a poor trading week for most fruit, and many lots available have a suspect shelf life due to the recent heavy rains in the growing
area.
Here
with this week's stock market report is David Williams.
Throughout New South Wales this week, there were lighter pennings of fat cattle. With these lighter pennings, there have been an increase in price for prime
grade. Moving on to River Heights for New South Wales, Burrendung Dam water level at 350 metres 23, a rise of 1 centimetre. At Wellington, 2 metres 50, a ford of 6. The Darling at Wilcannia, 344, a ford of 3. At Menindee Town, 460 in stationary. And a Batundi, no report. That's simple.
At the beginning of the decade, things were quite different. Then, quotas on production were controlling the amount of grain that was being produced, and many farmers were being forced to virtually walk off their farms. John Hinwood spoke to a Wimmera farmer's wife, who was, in 1970, in the process of leaving farming for good.
I'm very bitter, my husband too, because we've worked hard to get where we are today, and we went through the drought and we felt, well, we'll go on from here. But all of a sudden we get the wheat quotas and we're just not able to continue. If the government had given us some warning and we'd felt that it wasn't economical possible, well, we would have sold and got out with some security. But it's going to be terribly difficult, but we're prepared to do it.
In his outlook statement on the future of the meat industries, Mr. John Salt of the Bureau of Agricultural Economics said that the improvement evident in recent months in the beef industry will continue in the year ahead. However, he said, there is little indication of there being a dramatic upturn in sale yard prices. The reason he gives for the increased optimism is that the beef-producing countries around the world are now reporting lower levels of beef production. The United States of America, Japan and Canada have reasonably good prospects for higher economic growth in 1976.
You're listening to the ABC's Country Hour. It's 12:30.
The canned fruits industry, overproduction and this year lower payments to growers remain the big stumbling block. And the outlook is that marketing problems will persist for canning pears and peaches while production outstrips market outlets.
The amalgamation of the SPC Admona sales organisations with an invitation for every other canner to join that operation is the foundations of the one desk selling operation in Australia. Incidentally, that is designed for Australia and markets other than the United Kingdom.
Some farming news. The Minister for Health, Mr. Ralph Hunt, has announced new measures to be taken to control oriental fruit fly. Mr. Hunt was visiting the Northern Territory to examine the fruit fly position at first hand. He said that oriental fruit fly was now known to be widely dispersed. Well, that's just about it for today's Country Hour. Just a reminder about the...
That was a brief look at the 1970s. I wonder what the 80s will bring us.
Well, the 1980s was a political time for rural issues. This was the decade of the Australian Farm Rally, where 45,000 farmers marched on Canberra. They wanted to send politicians a message that they were sick of high taxes and rising farm costs. But the start of that decade was marred by drought. Melanie Sim has the story.
We saw the situation yesterday where a landholder at Patchy Wallach shot 700 sheep. Today I've been advised that in the Shire of Dunmunkle we'll be digging a pit and they'll be burying some 1,500 sheep in that pit on behalf of about 10 different landholders.
Cattle numbers have dropped by 50% in most of the drought-affected areas and by as much as 70% on the Northern Tablelands and Upper Hunter and as high as 80% on the South Coast and in the Braidwood area. In some area, cattle sales have been reduced from weekly to fortnightly because there simply aren't enough cattle left to sell.
It's really affecting the district very badly. The storekeepers, the local chaps that are, you know, do jobs that for graziers, they're of course are on the dole and they can't get work. Us personally, we've had to cut back and make sure that every penny we spend is, you know, spent the right way. Of course, the ewes are lambing now. We joined earlier in the year and you don't know what's ahead of you. You've got to take a punt. And now we've got lambs everywhere, of course, and what do you do? It's very depressing, actually.
The drought of 1982-83 affected most of eastern Australia. Sheep were being shot in huge numbers and cattlemen were struggling to feed their stock. Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser turned to Western Australia for help.
I'm told that Western Australia could take up to a million sheep at the moment with the feed that they've got over there. And with the reduced freight rates to the west, if the states are prepared to agree, then freight subsidy can be payable on sheep going from drought-declared areas into Western Australia, so long as it's a farmer-to-farmer operation.
Just 3 years later, the country was still recovering when farmers took to the streets angry at a proposed consumption tax.
The message is clear for all these people here today and could be the beginnings of a total revolt against the excesses of government.
The year was 1985 and the new Prime Minister Bob Hawke hosted a national tax summit to overhaul the current system. Farmers were worried the proposed new taxes would lead to a massive hike in fuel prices and other farm costs. So on the first day of the summit, 45,000 farmers marched through Canberra. National Farmers Federation President Ian McLaughlin.
Unlike our competitors in the US and Europe, we don't want to be subsidised to produce and then subsidised to export. We're not after short-term handouts from this or any other government. We haven't got them now and we don't want them in the future. But we are sick and tired of subsidising the rest of Australia. It's costing us more than $1 billion every year. We want the government to remove taxes on our productive inputs. We want all the taxes taken off fuel. All the taxes taken off fuel. So that we can get down to level terms with those competitors I just mentioned.
Mr. Hawke.
I recognise that in the position with which you are faced today, that the cost increases that have occurred are pushing you into a position which is intolerable. My friends, I can understand. We will do all that is within our power to reduce the impact of costs upon you, and particularly in the fuel area.
From where we're standing, just at the end, just to the north of the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge, as far as we can see, there seem to be farmers and banners, both sides of the bridge, in fact.
Well, there's just hundreds and hundreds of people walking silently past, but the motivation that must have been necessary, the motivation that must be there to get so many people to come out like this and walk down the streets of Canberra, just quietly making their message.
And when you say come out, we're actually talking about from some of the most remote parts of Australia.
Yes, they are. They've obviously come from all over, and they're average cockies, these people. There's just so many of them that really, if I was a politician, I would be taking very close note.
You could sort of see the frustration sort of bubbling out everywhere. It was just, I think it was a credit to everybody that was there that they contained themselves as well as they did. Because I know how I felt, and I bet a lot of other blokes felt like me.
Politicians are numbers men, and they see that number of people there, well, they do realise that rural Australia is getting serious about its problems. And I came to just put that extra drop in the ocean. And I think that's why everybody came.
After the summit, Treasurer Paul Keating fought for the consumption tax, but the PM Bob Hawke became worried about its political consequences. The summit showed it would be opposed by a wide range of people, not just farmers. So in August, it was buried. New reforms were announced, like taxes on fringe benefits, capital gains, and the tightening of tax provisions in areas such as farm losses. But many farmers felt that the Australian Farm Rally was the real success, as it showed politicians what rural Australia was made of.
And I think that there's going to have to be a sequel to this, and I think it'll have to be in the form of failing to supply goods and produce. In other words, turning off of the supply to the sale yards of meat and possibly of milk and certainly of fruit and vegetables.
That's a farmer at the 1985 rally. It doesn't really seem that long ago. The 1990s itself was pretty turbulent as well. Another severe drought, a recession, the waterfront dispute and the wool market crash. Melanie Sim caught up with wool grower and writer Charles Massey. In his book, Breaking the Sheep's Back, Charles describes the 1991 price reserve scheme collapse as Australia's biggest business disaster.
At the end of the Second World War stockpile, the agitation began to have a reserve price buffer scheme. Agitation increased through the 60s, led by Bill Gunn, who was then head of the Woolgrowers' Bodies. He was best friends with Black Jack McEwen, who by then was the most powerful man in federal government. They had a referendum in 65 that was defeated narrowly, and that's when McEwen and Gunn put their heads together and said, well, we're not going to win this way, let's go under the table. They railroaded the scheme in. The idea was to establish a buffer stock scheme, which means buying in supplies when the prices are low and then putting them back on the market as prices increase to stable prices. When we moved into the 80s and the boom period of the global economy, the same infectious boom mentality infected the wool leaders, both on the agri-political bodies and the wool boards. The market peaked early in 1988 at 1,230 cents then, which is massive. And they set a very high floor at 870, which was way above historical market. Almost within a year of setting that high floor price, the global economy turned down. By late 89, it had crashed so much, and because they wouldn't remove the floor, the customers just evaporated. The major commodity buyers and the specialists in Italy and everyone, there was no orders in the pipeline. Eventually, Treasury had to step in. They tried a false move to lower the floor price, which only destabilised confidence further, in about May 1990. And 9 months later, the situation was so desperate that Treasury and the government said, that's it, and they cancelled the floor price and the wool market halved overnight. Ramifications for both wool growers and customers was catastrophic. Global increase in textile demand rose by something like 80%. Polyester, cotton grabbed all that. So the opportunity cost was enormous because not only had a lot of our customers gone broke, but they swore never to come back. So we lost them permanently. The bankruptcies, the suicides, the family breakups, people still come up to me today and are continually telling stories of 1991.
That's the sound of the waterfront and the subject of a good deal of controversy this lunchtime.
The National Farmers Federation has announced details of a plan to tackle the issue of waterfront reform by setting up its own stevedoring company. Federation President Donald McGauchie is one of three directors of the new company, registered as PNC Stevedores, which he says will start operating when the right opportunity arises.
Donald McGauchie says the cost of moving containers is 40% above world's best practice, and they want to reduce that by 25%.
At the other end of the decade, 1998 saw one of Australia's greatest industrial wars between shipping company, Patrick Stevedores, the Maritime Union of Australia, and farmers. The NFF became a key player in the waterfront dispute in early January as it tried to break the union movement and improve productivity on the wharves.
What do grassroots producers think of the concept of the National Farmer Lobby Group getting directly involved in stevedoring at the ports?
Well, it's got to happen. They're holding the country to ransom. We know personally some of the fellas that worked on the wharves, and we've heard all their perks. Unions and that, they're just trying to hold the gun at everyone's head.
On the 8th of April, the war on the waterfront really heated up when Patrick's imposed a lockout at its ports.
As you've heard, Patrick Stevedores has announced the sacking of its entire workforce around the country. Patrick's chair, Chris Corrigan, told the ABC the company has entered into contracts for a range of services from 9 separate companies, including the National Farmers Federation's non-union stevedore operation. But what do city people think about the waterfront dispute?
Well, I just hope that next time the farmers put their hand up for a rescue package, that the workers of this country remember what they've done.
The MUA raised $60,000 for drought relief in the recent farmhand appeal. Donald McGeckie is a multi-millionaire pastoralist. The MUA has exempted farm products from industrial disputation for the past 10 years. And I bet in the next drought, or the drought that's occurring now, unionists are putting their hands in their pockets and giving money to farmers. So I want to know whether the average farmer out there reckons the MUA has done them hard.
Meantime, the head of the farmer-backed contract labour company, PNC Stevedores, Donald McGeckie, says his group has enough trained staff to get the Patrick's operation up and running again within a couple of days.
We can supply sufficient to make the outfit run. You see, one of the problems here is that the MUA would not face the reality that even the Hawke government tried to persuade them of, that this industry needed significant reform. You don't need 1,400 real workers to replace 1,400 wharfies.
How many have you got?
Enough.
Back in 97, Patrick's had divided its business into different companies through a complex restructure. After the lockout of April 98, the case went before the federal court, where Judge Tony North found...
By dividing the functions of employing workers and owning the business between two companies, the Patrick Group put in place a structure which made it easier to dismiss the whole workforce. It is arguable on the evidence that this was done because the employees were members of the union.
Patrick's appealed to the High Court with the government's backing. But in early May, the High Court ruled in favour of the union, and the NFF-backed Labor company was forced off the wharves.
The National Farmers Federation supported the establishment of PNC less than 6 months ago. But since a court decision forced the employer company Patrick's to re-employ its union workforce, PNC has been left unviable, its workers idle. PNC Director James Ferguson gave the details on the company's wind-up to Louise Darmody.
We're going to see a much leaner workforce which has no overmanning. We're going to see the worst of the rorts removed.
The unionists are going to have their pay cut, but it's believed that productivity payouts will make up for these cuts. Doesn't seem like there are a lot of wins or a lot of changes there to me.
Well, that might be the impression, the reality is very different. And I think that we've done more than anybody else has done in a couple of generations to fix it. And if it's not fixed this time, well, we'll fix it next time.
The waterfront dispute of 1998, ending our look at the 90s. Now, if there's one thing farmers need more than ever in the 2000s, it's resilience. More drought, impacts of the mining boom, and changing attitudes to live exports have all added to the pressures of farming life. In our look back at the noughties, we'll begin by standing next to a very dry Murray River.
Yes, we're 70 kilometres upstream from Mildura, and I'm where the Chalker Creek meets the mighty Murray River, although at the moment it's not very mighty here at all. In fact, there's a large sandbar in the middle of the river, and you can walk through out to the sandbar. And for the first time in history, the farmers here have a zero water allocation.
For much of the early 2000s, farmers across Australia have been suffering from drought. The Millennium Drought is recognised as the worst recorded since white settlement. Australia's food bowl, the Murray-Darling Basin, was feeling it in 2007 when the Country Hour hosted a national broadcast.
How many trees do you think are dying at the moment?
That's a hard question to answer because there are a lot of people have decided to turn water off some of the less valuable crops, and there are other people actually that I know that have sold their water off permanently to sort of get themselves out of debt and probably go and get a job somewhere else.
The drought continued Australia-wide until late 2009, and by the end, $4.5 billion in drought assistance had been provided.
We are saying, give sheep a chance.
1, 2, 3, 4.
No sheep exports anymore.
A turning point in attitudes towards live animal exports came early in the decade with the fiasco of the Cormo Express. In August 2003, the ship left Fremantle with 58,000 sheep bound for Saudi Arabia. The Saudis rejected the sheep on disease grounds and then began a three-month saga of trying to sell or give them away. Australians were outraged about the animals' welfare, with radio stations flooded with calls, leading to industry regulator Live Corp calling for a media blackout. CEO Kevin Shield said negative publicity around the stranded sheep led to a deal with Pakistan falling over.
The publicity in Australia
was replicated overseas and I think made the job a lot more difficult.
Bring the sheep back from Kuwait.
The protests continued with more countries rejecting the sheep, forcing the federal government to step in. Agricultural Minister at the time, Warren Truss.
We therefore believe that the only practical fallback option is for the sheep to be brought home to Australia. There are some quarantine issues associated with returning the sheep to Australia, but we believe they can be managed.
But farmers were horrified by this suggestion due to the sheep being in a region rife with animal disease. In the end, the sheep didn't return. After 3 months at sea, a solution was found.
I know there have been many people who have been sceptical that this day would ever come. We've made contact, we now believe, with around 57 different countries in seeking to negotiate an arrangement which would lead to the unloading of the sheep. I'm very pleased that the 52,000 sheep are being unloaded in Eritrea.
By the time the sheep hit the North African country, around 10% of the flock had died and the exercise had cost $10 million. Meat and Livestock Australia's David Crombie was part of the team unloading the sheep.
In the future, MLA is calling for improved systems to make sure this doesn't happen again. If animals are turned away from a market, we need to have an alternative.
A review into live animal exports was hastily conducted. This was far from the end of controversy over animal rights, though, with many inquiries to follow.
I came 2 years ago and the town was absolutely just buzzing and pumping. Like, I go to the shops and I felt like that I was out of dress code because I wasn't in high vis.
The mining boom. While farmers were battling with drought and attitudes towards animal rights, some regional areas were benefiting from a huge injection of cash. The Reserve Bank tips the start of the boom around 2005. Traditional iron ore town, Karratha, in WA, was transformed into a bustling hub once the production of liquefied natural gas began to take off in 2007. Long-time local, Terry Swetman.
Woodside came in and then Woodside started developing the town and things started to change rapidly. Where the truck stop is out of town, before that was built out there, you could quite easily see a lot of tents, cars, campers, and people sleeping out around there because there was just no accommodation in town at all before the camps. So that's where they were sleeping a lot of the time.
With the boom came the bust as the iron ore price fell on the back of lower demand from China. By 2014, it wasn't just mining employees feeling the pinch. Small business owners were too.
I went back east, came back because I knew that I was going to set up a business, and I was like, whoa, where's all the people gone? Sort of wonder now, did I make the right call? I just thought being here in a mining town would be a bigger turnover.
We end where we began. Drought. Today, 80% of Queensland is suffering. It's the most widespread on record.
Drought's just an oncoming thing out here. You'll learn to live with it. And so we've put in 120k a pipe in the last 2 years. We're in process of putting a fence around the property. There's a big cluster fence with three properties joining to control the migration of kangaroos and keep out the wild dogs.
You just take one day at a time. Winter's not so bad. You get to stop. You can draw a breath. Summer is just day after day of hard slog and high heat. But you just got to look on the bright side. You got to pick some positive side every day and just keep sticking your head down, bum up, and keep working.
Even though it's a drought and hard times, you always find something you like. Just for instance, yesterday morning we had a big fog come in and yeah, it was spectacular in the morning watching the sunrise over the fog. You know, things like that, images like that, you sort of, yeah, you fall in love with it and you fall in love with the country.
And the music you're listening to there is called Renewing Rain. It was commissioned by the Camerata of St John's Chamber Orchestra after the composer visited drought-stricken Queensland. Now, it was first performed in Chinchilla in August in that year, and the orchestra then toured Longreach in rural Queensland to try to bring some musical relief to drought-stressed communities. That wraps up our Decades series by Melanie Sim, celebrating 70 big years of the Country Hour.